cycling podcast Femina in association with RAFA. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee stops, RAFA exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
You are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, brought to you by Skoda. Dedicated to closing the gender gap in cycling, one race, one cyclist at a time. This is our time.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Rose Manley.
Hi, Richard. Hi,
and,
Ola.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, sorry.
Spoiled that.
Spoiled. Yeah, I that know. Was going to be the big
and
reveal.
We're joined
spoiler
by
alert, Orla's here. And Orla Shinawee.
Hello, both. Hello, hello.
How are we? Orla, we're just back from Innsbruck. Did you have a nice hot work trip?
It was the best holiday I've had in a long time, actually. Working hard. It was brilliant. Really enjoyed it. Thoroughly enjoyed the racing. Brilliant setting. I'll stop saying brilliant. But yeah, really good.
We will hear a package from there, quite a lengthy package that we recorded during the Women's Road Race. We've got quite a few interviews from there as well, not just from the senior race, but the younger age categories as well. Well, let's crack on with the news roundup because I'm sure, well, we're going to hear our package from Innsbruck, but I'm sure Rose has got a lot to say about the race as well, or the championships.
I'll think of something to say. It is it's a lengthy package that you have got, which is great.
Most of our listeners will probably have been following to some extent, at least the World Championships. But here's a quick roundup of what's been going on since last we conversed. We had the Women's Junior Time Trial, and that was won by Rose Marijn Ammerlaan of the Netherlands. She took the first rainbow jersey of the Worlds. 18 years old, the Dutch woman beat Italy's Camilla Alessio into second, and Britainer's Eleanor Backstead with a bronze. Did I say Britainer's? Did I?
Yeah, you did.
See, I've left the country and I can't speak English already. Britain's Eleanor Backstead, just 16 years of age. Of course, she's featured in the podcast before. We had an interview with her, the daughter of the former pro Magnus Backstead, Maggie Backstead, and the former British road race champion, Megan Hughes. The women's junior road race, local lass Laura Steger caused quite a stir in Innsbruck. She won the women's junior road race in her second ever road race, phenomenally. Usually a mountain biker. She actually won her second junior cross-country world title in Switzerland in September and took this title just 2 days after her 18th birthday. It was a thrilling finish to this race, a four-up sprint with silver going to France's Marie Lunette, a Madison world champion known for being a fast finisher, with Simone Bouillard of Canada in third. Women's elite time trial then, as predicted by yours truly. We had a 1-2-3 for the Dutch. Annemiek van Vleuten defending her title. Anna van der Breggen in second. And she was the only rider to finish within 1 minute of the winning time over the 27.7 kilometre course. And Ellen van Dijk was in third. Now, Leah Kirchman of Canada was in fourth. And I'm just looking through the top 10, and there were three nations really that dominated the top 10 in the women's time trial, because Caroline Canuel of Canada was also up there. She was in eighth. Three riders from the US, with Leah Thomas in fifth, double former world champion Amber Neben in seventh, and Taylor Wiles in tenth. Lucinda Brand made it four for the Netherlands in sixth, and Elisa Longoborghini was flying the flag solo for Italy, finishing in ninth. So not many nations sharing the top 10 there. The women's elite road race, I won't say very much about this at all because we'll be coming to this in detail, but the win went to Anna van der Breggen with Amanda Spratt in second and the former world road race champion Tatiana Guderzo in third. So in other news, the UCI has announced new reforms to women's cycling, which we will be discussing in a little bit. It includes a minimum wage for the first time, much hyped, of course, and a two-tier system whereby five teams will form the top tier in 2020, and that will be called, they will be called, rather, Women's World Teams. Now, the new women's calendar will be called the UCI Pro Series, and that will sort of mirror the men's reforms. And we'll have three categories, the Women's World Tour and Class 1 and 2. There will also be new contractual regulations, which are supposed to improve the working conditions for women in cycling. But it was the minimum wage, of course, which got the most attention, with some reports that it would be £38,000 as the initial minimum wage. Turns out, far from the case, really. It will be introduced gradually, and the plan is for it to eventually equal the men's Pro Conti level as it stands at the moment, and that will be before 2023. Now, the current minimum salary for men's Pro Conti teams is 30,000 euros. Well, just over 30,000 euros. We have a new race as well. Dun, 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 dun. I should be doing that with bagpipes.
That was more didgeridoo, wasn't it?
But it was a bit of a mixture, yeah. The new Women's Tour of Scotland, a 3-day event to run from the 9th to the 11th of August next year. It will be a category 2.1, so that's the same level as a 2-day Women's Tour to Yorkshire. Unfortunately, it will clash with the European Championships, so a bit of a date clash there, but it will be the 4th UCI-ranked women's race in Britain alongside the OVO Energy Women's Tour and the Ride London Classic, and it means that in the UK, we'll have the same number of UCI-ranked races for men and women, which is good.
Can I just interject as well? I mean, it includes a participation rate for 5,000 people.
That was my next line.
Oh, sorry. Oh. But I just want to say that this is great news. I mean, what more could we want than the Women's Tour of Scotland? But it does address a problem from the last few years that the Women's Tour has never been to Scotland.
Mm. It's never been to Northern Ireland either, though. You're not the only ones.
The Tour of Britain regularly goes to Scotland, but the Women's Tour has never been to Scotland. Partly that's to do with the length of it, but you know, Scotland is a great place to have a stage race, obviously.
Scotland is great.
In the old days, there were stage races, quite long stage races in Scotland. So I think it's great to see that tradition being revived and with a women's race.
Well, I've ridden Etap Caledonia a few times, which is the mass participation ride in Scotland. And it's very well organised. And, you know, they've got a good tradition of sportives up there as well, which hopefully this will incorporate with the mass participation event.
That I was about to mention.
And maybe, I'm presuming it's mixed sex, the mass participation event. I'm sensing maybe a little bit of a Cycling Podcast Feminine foray into the hills of Scotland led by Dickie Moore over there, what do we think?
Let's check on the route first.
Let's check how much downhill there is. Let's park ourselves in
Richard's slipstream. Even side by side. Substantial slipstream.
Anyway.
You don't get much of a slipstream at that speed, I can tell you.
Anyway, moving on. Britain gains a race but loses the prospect of a team because One Pro Cycling had announced that they were starting a women's team next year while folding their men's outfit, but that's now not going to be the case. It had been thought that the existing sponsors would move across to the women's team, but apparently it's because of a lack of sponsorship that they're having to scrap the plan. So One Pro Cycling, in any of its forms, will be no more.
In fact, Britain is losing another two women's teams because Wiggle High Five, Of course.
Mm-hmm.
And WNT, which has been a British registered team, doesn't look like it's going to be a British registered team next year. They've lost their British riders and they've signed Lisa Brenner and Kirsten Wield. Mm. And so it looks like it'll be a German team next year.
So cycling doesn't lose that team, at least, just Britain. Doesn't really matter, I guess, in the grand scheme of it.
No.
In rider news, Julian Dora is leaving Mitchelton Scott for Bowles Dolmans, the Belgian leaving the Australian outfit after 1 year, and will continue, we understand, to combine road and track. She will booster the team's classic squad. So she'll be joining, of course, Anna van der Breggen, as well as the Tour of Flanders runner-up Amy Peters and Amstel Gold race winner Chantal Black. What a prospect for the classics. But it's also worth noting Danny Stamm, who runs that team, is a very seasoned six-day rider. And Julian Dora is, she said that she's hoping to gain from his experience in the Madison in particular. She was world champion in that last year and bronze medalist on the track as well from Rio in the Omnium. So Bowles Dolmans continuing, by the looks of it at least, with their flexible race programme for riders and not making them commit 100% to road results. That, I think, is your news roundup. Bite-sized version. Thank you.
Orla. That was great. A lot crammed in there. Shall we just go straight to Innsbruck?
Oh, let's. I feel like I'm missing it already.
Let's go back to Innsbruck. Unmistakable sounds, Orla, of a bike race in Europe.
Of a Dutch corner. We've only gone and found Dutch corner. It's written in the road here. Fans all gathered. Terrible Europop blasting. I love it.
We're at the women's road race. We've ridden out here on our city bikes, haven't we?
We have indeed. Me with my 5.5 month pregnant belly and all. It wasn't easy. I'm not going to pretend it was my most glorious moment.
moment, but we got a little bit of the way up the first climb anyway. It was good fun and worth it, actually, for this view. We haven't been out of the city to watch any of the racing so far this week, so it's nice to be able to see the race when it comes past on a climb.
You got your picnic?
I have my picnic, yes. Julie snuck into my bag this morning at breakfast from the hotel. I've got a few cheese sandwiches and an apple to keep us going.
Glorious, isn't it? It's been beautiful in Innsbruck itself, but as you say, this is our first time out on the course, and we're at, this must be the first hairpin, I guess, and there are a few people gathering here. The women are about half an hour away, we think. There's just been a bit of drama in the race. Annemiek van Vleuten, the favourite, has gone down and looked pretty shaken up after the crash. There was a traffic island in the road, and it seemed to be a sort of compression in the bunch, and a few of the riders quite near the front, Ellen van Dijk was another one, Danny Rowe was another one, went down quite heavily, and so that has shaken her up a bit.
Yeah, and it was all looking very straightforward until then. It was going at a fairly controlled pace. It's still very, very early in the race, so Annemiek has lots of time to get back on, but as you say, she did look shaken. And interesting to see, it was Ellen van Dijk who's pacing her back to the bunch. I wasn't able to actually see the crash at the time because we were making our way up this hill. Don't know where Anna van der Breggen is. I presume she won't be dropping back necessarily to help Annemiek, but we've been intrigued by the Dutch team orders, haven't we, in the build-up to this race. And we understand that the Dutch team manager warned the girl that if anyone didn't obey team orders today, they would never be selected to ride for the Netherlands again. So we'll find out, I guess, now a little bit about what those team orders exactly are, but Annemiek van Vleuten with a bit of work to do to get back on the bunch.
Or are you going to be able to resist joining in with sing-along here?
I've already been over.
It's really...
Touching.
Oh, God, please. Oh, no. Oh, dear.
Sweet Caroline. Look at them go. I love it. Never... So good.
That's you got a big smile
English.
From the policeman there.
He enjoyed that. I give him a little bit of a boogie as well. This is my kind of vibe. Yeah,
the other moment that caught my eye earlier on in the race was Tenniel Campbell, the Trinidad and Tobago rider, who had a mechanical problem. She jammed her chain, actually had her bike upside down. People on Twitter would no doubt be reacting with outrage to that, turning her bike upside down.
maybe but, not the moment.
No. But the neutral service cars just seemed to go past her and not stop to help her out. And it took a while for a team car to stop and give her a spare bike. Actually, she was off the back for a long time and way out the back of the convoy. The ambulance had gone past, but amazingly she got back on. She's 21 years old. She's based in Egla at the UCI World Cycling Centre. She's one of their protégés, as Chris Froome once was many years ago. But I was amazed that she got back on, and clearly a talented rider may well seek her out at the finish.
Yeah, I mean, amazed that she got back on, but also just amazed that the neutral service cars didn't stop to give her assistance. I don't understand how every rider in a World Championships cannot be treated absolutely equally. It's terrible that she was left to sort her own bike out and wait for the team car. I'm quite sure if she was from one of the bigger nations, that wouldn't have happened. But yeah, hopefully we'll get a chat to her a little bit later and see what exactly happened to her.
Well, let's venture on further up the mountain, or let maybe stop and do you bring a picnic blanket, or are we just going to stand up to eat our sandwiches?
We're going to stand up. Well, I can spread my bag on the floor. It's big enough for my backside. You'll have to sort yourself out.
Our pilfered sandwiches. Fantastic. Let's go and immerse ourselves in the atmosphere of the World Road Race Championships in Innsbruck. Well, we've wandered up to the fan zone, which is a little meadow overlooking Innsbruck, and it's really got the road on both sides, so we're looking down on part of the course, and then I think people leaning over the barriers, you'll be able to sprint across the meadow and watch the riders a little bit further up the climb. There are a couple of hot air balloons there waiting to take off. There are beer tents, there's a big screen, there's a lot of people, and it's a really fantastic setup. And Orla, there are portaloos.
First thing I noticed, Richard, I was a bit panicked about... Anyway, I won't go into that. But yeah, we didn't even need to bring a picnic. We've got picnic tables, beer, everything for you, obviously, hoping there's soft drinks for me. But isn't this absolutely wonderful? I mean, sometimes whenever I speak to friends who aren't into cycling and do not get it, I wish I could transport them to something like this. This is what makes cycling such a beautiful sport. You come to a brand new part of the world. I mean, I've been to Innsbruck before, but I'd never be up here in this part of Austria overlooking the city. And you're right close to the action. All the fans are here, the music, the atmosphere. It is wonderful. And Innsbruck so far, I think, have done a brilliant job of staging these World Championships. I mean, it's kind of easy because they've got the most remarkable landscape in which to host it. But they've done a brilliant job, and this fan zone, I think, is brilliant. I'm getting a little bit excited.
Well, it's funny because, as I think I've said already, Austria in the heart of Europe, but not really with that rich a tradition in cycling. But they've put on these World Championships extremely well so far. And, you know, the town has done a fantastic job of putting out the red carpet, really, for the race. But it's just a lovely kind of serene feeling place, isn't it? There seems to be very few cars. I mean, very little traffic. We've been riding around all week on the city bikes. Orla, you've pretty much had them on permanent hire because you couldn't work out how to use the app properly. And
objection here, Your Honour. I did keep forgetting to return the bikes, but at least I was able to hire them. You haven't even yet, how many days after landing in Innsbruck, managed to download the app to begin with.
I haven't figured that out, but you've not been able to return them properly, so our bike bill's fairly high. But if that helps to maintain these wonderful standards of cleanliness and everything else in Innsbruck, you're doing your bit there, Orla.
I am. And you know, it's brilliant.
Put something back.
It is brilliant as well. You can see how much everybody's getting into this, whether it's travelling fans or local fans. A lot of travelling fans, but the roads are covered in the usual paint marks. So people have been out preparing well in advance for these World Championships. Lots of Go Team NL. You've got the whole Dutch women's team written down on the road beneath us. So yeah, it just has a proper feel of an established bike race already. It's brilliant.
I like this chap's improvised picnic blanket.
He's just decimated a cardboard box. We're taking a chance he doesn't speak English because we're right beside him. But he's made himself almost like a cardboard crucifix on which he's
That's
laid himself.
Exactly what it is.
Just to house the vital parts
cardboard
of his body.
Crucifix, I like it.
But he's perfectly
he
happy. He's got his eyes closed, taking in the sunshine. Yeah. Does he know there's a bike race happening, do you think?
Oh, I think he does. I think he does. He'll wake up in time, don't worry. There's still a few minutes away. Let's go into the body of the Kirk, shall we? And and sample
and
some
pay,
of that.
Pay worship.
Sample some of it. I'm going to eat my free picnic, Orla, because you can take the boy out of Scotland, but you can't take Scotland out of the boy.
I think you might stretch your beer that way.
The race is close, Orla.
It certainly is. We've just jumped up from our picnic table. We were in dire danger there of munching on chips while the race went past after all that effort. Lead group of four.
Don't forget the sausage.
Don't forget, yeah, who can forget the sausage? My first Austrian sausage. Very tasty. Anyway, lead group of four at the minute. We've got Ellen van Dijk up there, Cecily Utrip-Ludwig. Who else do we have?
Lotta Lapisto's
Lotta
there.
Lotta Lapisto.
And an Italian. Who is it? Is it?
I was eating my sausage.
Priorities.
So far, nothing is going to break the race apart, certainly. It looks like, I mean, the Italian there probably for Lisa Longo-Borghini. Makes sense for Ellen van Dijk to be up there leading the pace for the Dutch. So far, so good for the Dutch. And Annemiek van Vleuten made it back onto the bunch quite quickly, although we saw that she looked a little bit uncomfortable on the bike. I think it looks like she may have been injured. And we'll know over the next couple of hours, I guess, how that plays out for her.
Well, she was back at the medical car getting some attention. But I guess the surprise is Utrip-Ludwig going out so early. But we've seen her do that before at La Course, of course. She went out pretty early, so it might work for her. I think she had appendicitis, I think, quite recently, so recovering from that. But yeah, there's a helicopter above us now, always a sign that the race is very close.
Yeah, I thought it was maybe a bit too early for Utrip-Ludwig. She did do it at La Course, but it didn't quite work out for her, did it? And this is a tougher course, so I think maybe she's gone a little bit too early, but you know, hey, she's a very attacking rider anyway. She wants to be in the front, race it from the front, and that's just what she's doing.
And we wait for the athletes from Australia.
Here they come. In fact, we can see them three times here, Orla, because we can see them way down below, approaching the hairpin below us, coming around that, and then they'll appear just below us in a moment. And then we'll sprint across the meadow and see them again.
We will indeed. It looks to be a very fast pace so far. It looked like they were shedding riders early on. It might have settled a little bit now, but certainly this isn't going to be an easy World Champs. It never is. The first of three laps now, and they're just coming into view. We can see Ellen van Dijk right on the front. They're down to three now. It looks like, have they lost at Utrecht Ludwig?
No, Utrecht Ludwig, sir.
I can't see past this group of Norwegian fans. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Welcome to the riders here in the fan zone in Agen.
Well, that went well.
Yeah, it's Tatiana Goderzo on the front there for Italy, along with Utrecht Ludwig and Ellen van Dijk.
The first people here are cheering this.
Man, that's fast. So lots of Apisto pretty much caught by the chasing pack there. And Lucinda Brand was the next of the Dutch. And it looked like Annemiek van Vleuten has had her number pinned back on again. She looks a little bit more comfortable as she went past, I thought.
The Australian team very prominent at the front, and a rider I spotted very near the front, young Sophie Wright, the British rider who was in the podcast a couple of episodes ago, only 19 years old. And well, we spoke to Julian Wynn the other day, didn't we, who manages the women's team, and he said that they weren't going to come into this race with a leader to protect. And it was really, you know, they've got Danny Rowe, they've got Hannah Barnes, Sophie Wright, but it's perhaps not a course to really suit any of them. And I think it's a case of just seeing what happens on the day and letting the course decide on which of those riders has got the best chance of the day. And Sophie Wright climbing very comfortably up with the leaders there. Orla, we got a little bonus watch of the race there as we rode back through town on our way to the finish, and we saw them pass. Amanda Spratt had fallen off going over the top of the climb, got back on, went off the front. She was in a group of five with Corn Rivera and others, and that was a very good position to be in, because behind, and you don't know this because you've been in the toilet in that hotel.
TMI, Richard.
Anna van der Breggen, well, Annemiek van Vleuten attacked, Ashley Momopasio chased her down, and then Anna van der Breggen went over the top. She hit the nuclear button.
She's gone.
She's gone. She closed a minute gap to the front group in the blink of an eye. And she's just ridden through everybody, apart from Amanda Spratt, who stayed with her.
So she's now out front with just Amanda Spratt.
They're on the climb, and those two are out front, 40 kilometres to go. And Anna van der Breggen looks in a very strong position. We've seen her do this before. But great move by Amanda Spratt to get herself up the roads and wait for one of the Dutch riders to come across, and she's got a very good chance now, and she's got a decent finish, you know.
And it's really funny, because before this race there was so much talk about how difficult it was and how maybe team tactics weren't going to play such a big role, because it could be just every woman for herself. And yet you look at the two that are out front. The Australians have done a great job. The Dutch have been phenomenal. Ellen van Dijk has been in the lead group all the way through. When she was dropped, then we saw Lucinda Brand, who's been up there all day. She made the attack across to that lead group as well. So yeah, brilliant team rides from both of those riders. And that is where Ashley Milman-Passio, we feared, may fall short, because she has nobody to work for her. And it looks like that may be the undoing of her. Although, I mean, we're still
Amanda Breggen has just ridden Amanda Spratt off her wheel already. Still with a lap to go and another climb to go. She's off on her own. I mean, the only thing I can think of now that might help the race, because we don't want it to be over at this point, is if Annemiek van Vleuten is really struggling behind and the others, because there's some strong riders back there. Ashley Momopasio, Cecilia Utrecht-Ludwig, we saw trying to counter Elisa Longo-Borghini. You know, a lot of strong riders, but they're not going to get organised to chase if van Vleuten is there lurking dangerously. So the best thing that could happen for the race is for it to be hard up this climb and for there to be a real sort out of that group behind Anna van der Breggen.
And you mentioned Elisa Longo-Borghini. The Italians have done a great job as well, and so the key now, I guess, is for the other nations and any other individual riders to be able to get together and try to bring this chase back, because it is a long way to go yet. There's a lot more climbing to do. No one is going to underestimate Anna van der Breggen out on her own, but they will have to sort of consolidate and coordinate this chase quite quickly. I mean, with the men's under 23 race, we saw the lead group had a lead of, what, over a minute at about this stage, I think, and that was brought back. Anna van der Breggen, though, can last on her own. We've seen this as classic van der Breggen of old that we haven't seen so much of this season.
Oh, the Austrian policeman just wrestled someone off the road. I just hope this was approved by the Dutch team, this move by Anna van der Breggen, or we could be watching her in a Dutch jersey for the last time.
Well, this is the thing, because we were saying, obviously, if one of the Dutch riders disobeys team orders and goes on to win the world title, then I can't really see them being not selected as defending champion next year. But the orders were probably just to support whichever of the two, Annemiek or Anna, was up the road first. So
I should say that's unconfirmed, because Anna van der Breggen actually denied that that was that had been communicated by the coach. She said she'd read it on the internet.
Yeah.
Bloody internet.
But it makes for a good story, eh? Don't let the truth get in the way of a good story.
Well, this, for me, is a surprising move here. I was not expecting
big group that now. I mean, we saw Cashin if he don't have a go, but the chase is not really on, is it? There's a lot of Dutch riders there as well. We were just closing anything down if anybody moves.
Yeah, at the moment there's a battle for bronze, certainly a potential battle for silver if that second group can manage to get up to Amanda Spratt. But I mean, we were waiting for the top 10 to cross the line, and we're already ticking into, what was it, 3-4 minutes before we get into rider number 8, 9, 10. It is completely blown apart. You've got to say Anna van der Breggen has this one won, and the battle now is for the rest of the medals.
Breaking news there from Orla.
Well, okay, maybe I'm not. I don't think I am being premature, am I?
No, you're not. No, you're not. I think the minute she took off, and nobody went with her, because nobody could go with her. It was obvious, and yeah, she's well capable of. We saw the Tour of Flanders, didn't we? Her going out, long way to go, and she can do this. And especially if she's got, you know, this, her strongest rival behind her riding in the same jersey.
And it's funny really that she managed to stay in the bunch for so long, and all the chat was about Van Vleuten and her crash and how she'd recovered from that. I would suspect that she was more of the marked woman than Anna van der Breggen, which if you consider she'd ridden for another nation might not necessarily have been the case. But yeah, whenever she made her jump, it's very easy to say, why did nobody go with her? Well, because it's Anna van der Breggen. How can you go with a machine like that? And she's looked so smooth, so in control, mouth open. She doesn't look like she's putting in any excessive effort whatsoever. Look at her. She's just riding as flat and as smoothly as you would imagine from van der Breggen. And this, finally, a world champion's jersey, it looks like, that will be in her back by tonight.
Tell me who you are.
Sandra Raatskelders.
Where are you from?
Hunsbrück.
So have you come over for the World Championships?
Yeah.
Are you a fan of the Dutch female riders?
Yeah, all the Dutch females.
No favourite?
Annemiek van Vleuten.
What do you think of Anna van der Breggen?
She's also great.
How do you explain how Holland has produced so many great female riders?
I don't know. The team...
The
team building, I guess.
And Marianne Vos, maybe she'd been a big inspiration.
Yeah, she's the biggest inspiration of all.
Is Anna van der Breggen going to win this?
Yeah. We are going to go world champion.
Describe your outfit. Your hat is spectacular.
Oh, thank you.
Orange feathered hat.
Yeah. And the Holland shirt from the world champion football. My job.
So you're going to have a big celebration tonight then?
Yeah, of course.
Maybe it started already.
Yeah, I'm doing it all day long.
Good luck. Thank you. We're back in the meadow, Orla. It's the morning after the day before, and we're reflecting on Anna van der Breggen's incredible win. And the debate is whether we have a worthy, deserving champion, a brilliant ride, but was it a great race? I would say that a race where you pretty much know the outcome with an hour to go, for me, that's not a great race.
But no debate whatsoever as to whether she's a worthy champion. She was phenomenal yesterday. I think up until the last 40K, it was an exciting race. We had lots of attacks. We had all the main players that we would have expected to be up there, up there. We had the drama of Annemiek's crash, Amanda Spratt crashed as well. And I was, I mean, yeah, while we were watching it, it then became a little bit of a procession whenever Anna Vandenbergen went away. But that's massively unfair to the difficulty of what she did. And, you know, it was quite remarkable that not only was the winning margin so large, but also then, you know, Amanda Spratt had to time trial her way to finish line for 40 kilometres. And then there was a big gap between her and third place, and then another big gap between third place and fourth and fifth. So it was an interesting dynamic on the road, and it was just a phenomenal race by Anna Vandenbergen. And, you know, given that this is really the one that's been missing and on her palmarès, I think she's very, very much a worthy champion. I'm glad that she won it. Not that that matters.
That wasn't a surprise. I mean, some surprise performance. Not that Amanda Spratt was the silver medalist, but Tatiana Guderzo, the Italian rider, 34 years old now, who was a world champion in Mendrisio in 2009, kind of similarly hit, not quite as tough as this, but quite a hilly course. Emilia Fallon surprised a lot of people to finish fourth. And really, in the top 10, Annemiek van Vleuten was seventh in the end with a broken bone in her knee. But a lot of the names that we expected to be at the fore weren't, really. And that was a bit of a surprise. In her press conference afterwards, Anna Vandenbergen, there was a very nice moment, actually, Orla, when you spoke to her about having bumped into her childhood friends at the finish line. In fact, will we hear from the childhood friends now? Let's do that. You spoke to them just before the finish. They were waiting for their friend to be crowned world champion.
So, ladies, are you both fans in general, then, of the Dutch women? Is there anyone in particular?
There's one in particular. Anna. It's written on our cheeks all over. It's Anna. It's the one and only.
Only that one. Why?
It's my best friend.
Really?
Yeah.
How do you feel? Your best friend is about to become world champion.
No, you don't want to know. You don't want to know. You don't want to know. This is just, yeah.
How long have you known her?
Kindergarten. Yeah.
And did you always know she had something special?
Oh, she can bike very good already, very long. She's a natural though, because she'd been biking for a very long time already, but everybody said if she could do more, she can become way, way better, and that's what she's doing right now.
So from the outside, we see Anna Vandenbergen as being very cool, very calm.
She is very humble.
She is.
Yeah, she's a very
humble.
That's
her normal way of being. She isn't
very down to earth. Yeah.
Yes.
And she doesn't really talk about this so much.
No.
Does she get excited about race wins and about bike?
Oh yeah, she does. Oh yeah. She maybe doesn't look like she's very excited, but she is. She's just really proud, but she's also just really down to earth.
She's really good at hiding it.
And she really likes to also just have a normal life instead of only biking. So, yeah.
What is a normal life for Anna Vandenbergen? What do you guys do together?
Family, friends, just being together. Not only biking, just also have a good time with friends and family.
How much will this win mean to her today?
Oh, a bit.
The world.
Yeah, honest.
Mean the world.
Yeah.
Because there's so much pressure on her that right now.
Yeah.
And the media is all over it, but she just wants to win it, and not even for herself, I think.
It would mean the world. It's just one that she didn't really got, so.
Can you explain to me how she's so good? The Dutch team are so strong, but Anna Vandenbergen has been a league apart for a few years now. How is she so good at what she does?
I don't know. She can focus on one goal really good, really well, and that's what she wants to do, and then she goes for that. Yeah.
She has an ability to go really deep, I think.
She can,
where others, when there's a bad weather or a lot of wind, or that's the best weather for her, then she lives up and everybody's having a hard time, and then she can, there she goes.
I'll let you watch the race, but what's the plan for the party tonight?
A lot of beers.
And Orla, when you mentioned to Anna Vandenbergen in the press conference that you'd spoken to her childhood friends, there was a rare moment of real warmth from her, because she doesn't exude warmth in interviews and in these situations. I think she's quite shy and not that comfortable in that sort of spotlight. But there was a real moment of spontaneous glee at the fact that you'd met and then mentioned her friends.
Yeah, it was like almost the barrier came down ever so briefly, and you got a glimpse into the war man and maybe the Anna that all of her friends know. She just went, oh, did you? And she was very excited that I'd spoken to Helma. And it was lovely. And she was saying as well that she doesn't usually have friends and family who come to races to watch her, and that she was very aware this time around that lots of them had made the journey. You know, we're not a million miles away from the Netherlands. And she said that she went out to dinner on the Thursday night before the race, and there were 14 of her nearest and dearest around the table, and she realised they were all there for her. There was great expectation on her, and there was a real warmth to her in the press conference. I thought she is a cool customer. Sometimes that just comes with that sort of singular focus that it takes to be a champion. And I've felt like, as well, somebody else asked her, what does it mean after all this time to be world champion? And she took a moment, she had a deep breath and said, yeah, that's a good question. Like, she was still trying to process it herself. And there was just a little bit of the human side to Anna, I thought, a little bit of that vulnerability that we all possess, but that champions have to build a barrier in front of. Yeah, it was a lovely moment.
Well, I thought as well that, you know, that completes the set for her, doesn't it? She's won pretty much everything else, but she also sort of mentioned just how nervous she'd been, and that she woke up on the morning of the race relieved that that night she'd be going to bed without the race on her mind anymore. And I thought that was really interesting, because there's been a sense all season, I think, of the pressure that she's felt to win this race and the expectation that she had of herself. And that came across when I spoke to her at La Course, and she was taking a little break and doing some mountain biking and doing other things. But she really didn't like the tone of the questions about this break that she was taking, and the theory behind it being that it was all about the Worlds for her this year.
Well, I guess as well we forget another aspect of which she addressed in the press conference yesterday, and that is a presumed team pressure as well. You know, Bols Dahlmans, for them to allow her to take a lot of the season away from racing and to concentrate on training instead in preparation for the World Championships. I know the initial plan had been for her to sit out a lot of the season. She didn't in the end. Don't know whether that came down to Bols Dahlmans simply saying, listen, you're one of the best riders in the world. We need you at the start line. But, you know, there is more and more competition for column inches apart from anything else, and certainly for race wins, than there have been before. Bols have been used to being dominant. They're not so much anymore, because we have seen the rest of the women's sport raise its game to a similar level. And so there was probably a lot of pressure on her, because they were turning up to races without necessarily a winner in their midst, or not an obvious winner. And the fact that she was sitting out these races probably added to all of that for her. But, you know, credit to the team that they allowed her to do largely do that anyway.
Because we're missing Lizzie Dagnan as well, which wouldn't have been part of the plan at the start of the season. One of the riders who really did light up the race, trying not to use the word animated, but she did light up the race, was Corin Rivera, the American rider on Team Sunweb. Not somebody that we necessarily associate with excelling in the mountains, but she rode extremely well. And you spoke to the finish, Orla. Here's what she said.
What were the tactics coming into today? Was it try to animate it as much as possible, try to help split it apart? Was it to try to watch and man-mark the Dutch?
Yeah, I think more about, you know, getting ahead of them, you know, because once they attack, I mean, it's you can see they just leave everyone. And so if you can at least get ahead of it and get a bit of a head start, I mean, that was our idea. And yeah, it's just hard because you're up against the best in the world, and once they start going uphill, they just leave you. So there's no coming back from that, so you really have to try to get ahead of it.
And you were on your own several times, and then it looked like, as you say, you looked behind, you saw that you could maybe work with a bunch and tried that instead. Was it quite a tactical day for you in that respect?
Yeah, it's just kind of me trying to figure out what the heck's going on. You know, I don't really know. Like, it wasn't very often that we had time gaps or that I knew where my teammates were, or so it was just hard to be in the middle of a lot of things. And I was hoping to try and maybe at least chase Spratt for silver, but yeah, then she ended up being too far out, so, and then I ended up back in that group, and then I exploded the last time up the climb. But yeah, I think I had envisioned my race to be over at that point, and leave it up to the girls. So, but I was giving everything I could while I was still in the medal contention.
So that was Corin Rivera, who wasn't really talked about an awful lot in the build-up to this race, actually. And whenever she was so active in the race yesterday, we all sort of scratched our head and wondered why we hadn't thought of her before. But one that certainly had been mentioned an awful lot was Ashley Moolman-Passio, the South African rider who has had a wonderful season, but still without one of the big wins to her name. And you spoke to her, Richard, before we came to the Worlds, and she had said that, you know, the lack of a team around her could really play against her. It was one of those races where we weren't weren't sure whether it was going to be so difficult and attritional that actually teamwork wouldn't matter so much. In the end, it did matter an awful lot, and Ashley feels that she probably suffered because of that. She just about missed the winning break as well in the end, so I asked her about that after the race. Here's Ashley Milman-Passio. Ashley, how much more difficult was a race like today without the support of a team? Because we were wondering whether it was going to be a day for teamwork or whether it was going to be so difficult that individuals would be able to contest the win themselves.
Well, the difficult thing about not having a team is that no one was really controlling the race, so it did end up being quite a tactical race. You know, usually something like this, which is a very climby race, you think it's going to come down to the strongest rider, but at the end of the day, there were a lot of riders that got away that, you know, weren't considered favourites. So in that way, it was a tactical race, and that's what made it difficult for me, because I had absolutely no team to help to control. So for a person like myself, it would have been in my favour to have had a team to control the race and to bring it to a point that was my strength.
Ashley Milman-Passio there, and all the talk about, you know, whether the Dutch team would be a cohesive unit. Well, four of them in the top nine in the end. And I spoke to Amy Peters, and it was a very good team performance. You know, Annemiek van Vleuten was taken away to hospital after the race and had a broken bone in her knee. She still managed seventh, incredibly, and then had to be carried away or carted off at the finish. She couldn't walk. Amy Peters was eighth. Lucinda Brand was ninth. Here's what Amy Peters had to say at the finish. Perfect day then for the Dutch team today.
Yeah, it was a really good day. We had a strong team, but at the end it's also sometimes harder when you have such a strong team. But everything was perfect. We had good tactics with each other, and we trust each other, and then this is a good result.
And Annemiek had a crash, of course, quite early on. She seemed to have got quite badly hurt after that.
Yeah, I didn't spoke with her yet, but I saw she went to the doctors. I hope she's okay. But I didn't speak with her, so I don't know what's going on.
And Anna van der Breggen, we know how strong she is, but when she went away so early on, still in the race, did you worry that it might be too early?
No, because I know she wanted it really, really, so at the end, I knew when she has a cap, she goes for it, and she's strong enough for it, and she trained really hard for it. So, yeah, and when it was too early, then we still had Annemiek, so that's also good. But, yeah, I really believed in her because she was so focused, and, yeah, I'm really happy for her.
There was a moment in the race when there was a group up with Amanda Sprannett, you had Ellen van Dijk there, but that was slightly dangerous, was it not? And they had about a minute. Was there even a little bit of worry at that point?
No, I don't think so, because it's really hard, this parcours. And 1 minute is not that much when you have a hill with from 8 kilometers. So I think it was good. And even Ellen is also a really strong rider, so I think we had always the good perfect situation.
So there was a lot of talk before the race about the Dutch team and how united you would be. In the end, everything came together on the day, I guess.
Yeah, also before already. I mean, it's more the media who say a lot about it, but it's always clear for us what our job is. And also Annemiek and Anna, they're professional enough to race with each other. And yeah, we all want to have a Dutch winner, and at the end it doesn't matter who it is. And
a very convincing winner in the end.
Yeah, that's true.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Shoot à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast Team Car at the back of the pack, please.
The voice of Seb Piquet there reminds me to tell you that this month's episode sponsor of the Cycling Podcast Femina is, once again, The Economist.
Yes, it is. The Economist is about far more than just economics and finance. It covers a range of subjects from politics and business, science, technology, arts, and of course, even sport. The Economist helps readers prepare for what's going on in the world around them. And in today's dynamic world, facts matter more than ever. For over 170 years now, The Economist has delivered trustworthy intelligence that helps people like you choose where to stand on the issues that matter the most. Now, Richard, you were tasked with finding an article that interested you this month. What have you got?
Well, two, actually. We're in an airport all on our way home from the World Championships, and there was a story about the trade in passports, how a lot of countries are selling passports and citizenship, and about the rules, if there are any, concerning multiple passports. You're not a multiple passport holder yet, are you?
I'm a dual passport holder, so Northern Irish, you're born dual nationality, British and Irish. I'm also going to be applying for my French through my husband, and my daughter has got four nationalities because she's Moroccan as well.
Wow, wow, wow. But the story that also caught my eye is the first in a series called The Tenth City. This is
interesting because the Economist notes that while Europe's capitals are booming, most voters don't live there. So they have begun an occasional series on country's 10th largest city. And the first in the series is a focus on Lille, the northern French city that a lot of us pass through in the Eurostar and don't maybe get much further than the Eurostar terminal. A really interesting piece, and it's an interesting sort of experiment to take a barometer of a country through its 10th largest city. I've no idea why they chose 10th largest city, but what can we learn about France from Lille? Well, there's a lot happening in Lille, and it's fascinating the impact of the Eurostar. Between 1975 and 2010, 70,000 industrial jobs, it was a very industrial city, were lost there. And the city's mayor persuaded the government to direct the new TGV line from Paris and Brussels to the Channel Tunnel via his city when that opened up. And that has really had a transformative effect on Lille, and certainly on the centre of Lille. But there are still big problems on the outskirts, huge unemployment, and there's a part of Lille which the Boulevard de Metz is nicknamed locally the Boulevard de Merde. So not very nice. But really interesting look at the 10th largest city in France. It got us thinking, what's the 10th largest city in Britain? Any bets?
No, well, I don't know whether they'll do the 10th largest in England or the 10th largest in the UK, because then you're factoring in Belfast and Glasgow and Edinburgh. I guess it's somewhere like, I mean, you're going past Liverpool, Manchester, London. I don't know, what would be the 10th largest? Something like Hull? Would that be too small? I don't know. But yeah, I mean, that's interesting because you get into the belly of the country then and you don't get the same factors in a city that can sway the economy. You know, if you live in a big city, then it tends to attract an awful lot more investment than a medium-sized city. So I guess you get more into the heart of a country, really. It's good.
Another line that caught my eye in the centre of Lille, in some of the more happening parts, is a bilingual creche that offers its infants English as well as organic meals. And there are people...
You say that like organic meals is a language. It's a bilingual creche that offers English and... by organic,
I'm just quoting the story, Orla. But there are people who live in Lille and commute to London, in fact. Quite a few people do that. Anyway, if you can name the 10th biggest city in the UK, you can win a free copy of The Economist, can't you? You can do that anyway.
Yeah, you can. You don't need to name the 10th largest. But give it a guess, actually, because you've got me thinking now. I'm going to go and Google that, but that might not be as easily said as done. But yes, you can get a free copy. The Economist is the smart guide to the forces changing your world. So to get your free copy, your free print copy, I should say, text BIKES to 78070. That's a free print copy of The Economist to all listeners of the Cycling Podcast Feminine by texting BIKES to 78070.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thank you very much indeed to Rafa for being our main sponsor at the Cycling Podcast and the Cycling Podcast Femina. And, well, finally, at the World Championships, I got to present a Pedaleurs de Charme t-shirt to Cecilie Uttrup-Ludwig, who was our runaway winner at La Course in July.
Runaway winner.
Yeah, she was obviously a very popular nomination. She's a natural Pedaleurs de Charme, isn't she? I mean, she rode well in the women's road race. Well, we saw her. We'll hear in a moment that she didn't think she rode that well, but we saw her in the women's road race in Innsbruck. And, I gave her the t-shirt. And Orla, you spoke to her just before I gave her the t-shirt. She was delighted to receive her t-shirt, obviously.
She was. And I have to say, though, I've tried this a few times with you now. As I understand, the pronunciation
Cecilia.
Is...
Cecilia. I was trying to say it correctly.
No, in Danish, apparently it's Cecilia.
Oh.
But in English, she pronounces it Cecily.
Oh, Cecily,
sorry. Cecily in English or Cecilia.
I think people always call her Cilla?
Yes, they do. And I thought that was one too many. I thought if we can get one of those two right, it might be better. So Cilla.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. I don't know.
She's not a Cilla to me.
She's not a Cilla, no.
If you grow up in this country, yeah, Cilla
is only
blind date. Here's our Graham with a quick reminder.
Yeah.
No.
Should have got that printed on a t-shirt instead of Pedaleurs de Charme.
Anyway, here's Cilla.
Cecily.
Cecily speaking to Orla.
Can I ask in English for the podcast? Hi. Thank you. Hi, how are you?
Good, and you?
Yeah, very well, thank you.
I love
you.
The podcast,
oh,
you know.
Thank you.
But you're so well prepared always. It's always so good, you know, and yeah.
Oh, I don't know about that. We wing it.
No, it's good.
Cecily, you were involved in the attacking moves right from the off today. You clearly wanted to animate that race. What was your thinking going into today?
Yeah, I mean, it was clear that, you know, I wanted an advantage, you know, on the climb. So, yeah, I was trying to see or trying to get in a breakaway before the laps, or at least, you know, when we were in the circuit. And that happened, but it was not the right breakaway, obviously. So, yeah, I should have been in the next one. But, yeah, it's a bike racing, but... Yeah, and I think I made a lot of mistakes and could have used my energy in another way. But yeah, I think I need to go home and need to analyze the race again and to learn from my mistakes, because, you know, I'm still young and I have a lot of world championships to come, you know. So yeah, hopefully I can get more experience and get better.
What part of the race in particular will you be studying when you watch back? Where did you think you made the mistakes? I mean, you've only just lived it, so it's a bit difficult to put it into context, but is there anywhere in particular?
Yeah, I mean, so when we were caught again on the top of the climb, the downhill, and then when the breakaway with Amanda went, and also obviously when Anna went, I mean... The moment where Anna went was a very tough moment, and at that point I couldn't follow her, or I was, you know, I was too far behind, which is stupid and something that is not allowed to happen, you know, if you want to go for a better result. I need to become a better bike rider, and I think I have a lot of potential to grow, because as I said, I made a lot of mistakes, and it'll be better for the upcoming years. I think so.
Well, we heard Cecily Utrup-Ludwig there, very hard on herself because she's still very young, of course. We've seen quite a lot of her this year in the big races. I think, you know, she will go back, and when she doesn't have so many health problems that she's had this year, we're going to see some big results from her, I'm sure, sometime soon. But Rose, sadly you weren't with us in Innsbruck. Were you able to watch the race, and in particular, I mean, what did you think of the women's road race? Because the debate has centred on, with Anna van der Breggen going clear so early, and the contrast with the men's race, which was very open until the, you know, final few hundred metres.
Well, the final meter.
You know, everybody agrees it was a fantastic winner. Was it a fantastic race?
Well, it's funny because I did something which I don't normally do, because normally I'm either at the races or watching it live at the time. Instead, I was at a wedding at the time, so I watched it on catch-up and watched the BBC coverage. And, I mean, their coverage was live, but it started with about 43k left to go. So when I watched it, starts at 43k to go, Lucinda Brand attacks almost immediately. The break was still ahead, and then Van Vleuten attacked, then countered by Van der Breggen, and then she was off. So for me, it was almost like as soon as the live coverage started, it was 3 very quick kilometres of action, then the race was decided. And then it's just watching the camera go from Anna van der Breggen out the front to Amanda Spratt, and then Guderzo a bit further behind. So for me, it wasn't interesting. It wasn't a good race, but
I suppose... I've seen people on social media say, well, if it was a man riding away with, you know, Peter Sagan won Paris-Roubaix, but it was always in the balance there. The gap wasn't so big that you knew he was going to win. Whereas with Van der Breggen, it just kept increasing. And also, I mean, going back a few years when Cancellara, when he won Paris-Roubaix in similar fashion, that was boring because, again, it was decisive and we knew what the outcome was going to be very early on. And so I don't think it matters if it's a male or a female rider. When a rider is that strong and able to go away and just keep increasing the lead to the extent that you know what the outcome is going to be, that's when the race loses its, I suppose, attraction.
But I guess my perception is skewed by the fact that I wasn't seeing the action before that. But then I always think, as exciting that kind of aggressive racing at the beginning is, when it doesn't actually affect the actual outcome, it doesn't really matter in the end.
I mean, I think it's really unfortunate that was the only bit that you're able to see in catch up. I do think that from what we learned or heard from our BBC colleagues who were out there that they were on the red button all day. Mm. So maybe they just didn't put the whole red button on catch up. But in defence of the race, I think it was really exciting until the last 40 kilometres because it was completely wide open and there were lots of attacks and counterattacks, and we had big riders up the road in potential breakaways who were then brought back by other big riders, and it felt very open until the last 40 kilometres. Obviously, the end of a race is the crunch point and that's where you want the action to happen. But I was just doing calculations earlier, and if you compare the men's and the women's races, for example, with the women's race, we essentially had 116 kilometres of really good racing. In the men's, we had 70 kilometres of really good racing. So with the women, we had 40 kilometres that was quite boring. With the men, we had 189 kilometres that was quite boring. And like I say, it's the excitement, you want that to be weighted towards the end. And we are used to, with men's racing, watching a lot of it just ticking along, ticking along, ticking along, and then building up to the climax. With the women's race, I mean, it was unfortunate, really, from a race point of view, that it was essentially nullified from 40 kilometres. But if you're watching before then, it would have looked brilliant. Which then makes me think, when we were talking about, and there was so much chat beforehand as to whether the woman should have been racing up Hull Hoedinger, which was the hell climb at the very end, is there an argument that actually, as it was, the race was too difficult and should it have been a little bit shorter so it was punchier all the way through?
Or, counterintuitively, we've got an email here from Tom Baker, not the former Doctor Who, I don't think.
Could be. How do you
he's
know?
Asked,
I love,
Tom,
I love
Tom,
your references.
Tom, Tom's
like, we'd all be thinking, oh, former Doctor Who's been emailing.
Well, he asks about the women's race. And this is an interesting point because there was this discussion about whether it should have gone up the incredibly steep hill climb. Would the women's race have been as exciting as the men's if they had raced the same distance and course? Anna van der Breggen's dominance was awe-inspiring, but would she have held back for the final climb if they were racing 260 kilometres and given us a spectacle on a par with the men's race? I mean, impossible to know, but you're tempted to think it was already too hard because the strongest rider in the race was really able to hammer home her dominance. But on the other hand, if they'd had that climb, you know, it didn't have to be the same length, if they'd had that climb at the end, I would have quite liked to have seen that regardless, because there's no doubt women are perfectly capable of riding a climb like that, and it does produce something a little bit different, and it would have added an extra little dimension to that final lap as it did in the men's race. And so it would have been quite nice to see that. I don't think it would have affected the outcome at all. I
mean, Wouldn't it have been more likely that we would have seen much more of the stalemate that we saw in the men's racing for longer, and we wouldn't have seen the aggression from the off? And I guess, to play devil's advocate, if we had seen that and we had a spicier finish, would that have mattered?
Surely a spicier finish is better than...
Better than a whole, than most of the race being good.
Yeah, I think so. I think so, because although it's exciting to watch at the time, really, the only thing that really matters is if something is watching a move and saying, is that the decisive move? And I think as much there was big name riders in the break early on and lots of attacking, I don't think anyone thought that is the decisive move until Anna van der Breggen went. And then that, you know, there was one kind of thought where you thought this is going to stick, and then it did. And then it's kind of like,
I mean, it's terrible that we're sort of reflecting on the race in this way.
Oh, no, it is.
Van der Breggen's, you know, triumph. And, and, you know, boring is perhaps an overstatement because, as you probably heard in the package, you know, watching it, even when we knew the outcome, it was still, there was still a thrill in watching somebody at, really at the top of her game. And she's an incredible rider to watch when she's like that. She's so smooth.
Beautiful.
Incredible sort of strength and power. And, you know, it was a work of art in a way by her. And so we can appreciate that and admire that and enjoy that. We're maybe getting bogged down a little bit in wanting, and we're not always going to have races, and it doesn't matter, again, whether it's a men's or a women's race. Some races are going to play out in a certain way and other races are going to play out in another way. And
I think we cannot possibly take away from the phenomenal achievements of not just Anna van der Breggen, but Amanda Spratt and Guderza as well, time trialled their way to the finish.
Well, Guderza is a great story as well, actually.
Absolutely.
That in a way kind of, I mean, I think I've overlooked that as well a bit, that, I mean, Guderza is like a pure championship rider. To have got to have been a world champion before and then also to have got a silver, and then at the age of 34, which isn't old, but bearing in mind that her, I think she won in 2009
in Mendrisio, yeah.
I mean, that's just, and her first, she first got her, she got the silver medal at the world champs when she was, I think, like 20 years old. and she's still performing. She's a track rider, so I think we don't necessarily see her all year round. But I think she's a great story, and there were lots of great stories there. But I think maybe Anna's dominance kind of hides all those other amazing stories.
You are listening to the cycling podcast Feminin, brought to you by Skoda. Dedicated to closing the gender gap in cycling, one race, one cyclist at a time. This is our time.
Thank you very much indeed to Skoda for their support of the cycling podcast Femina this year since the women's tour. Very much appreciated. Heard Julia Elliott there, who is a Skoda-sponsored athlete and a very interesting racer. She's versatile. She does all the fixed wheel crits. She does
red hook crits.
Road racing. She does mountain biking. She's a coach. She does a lot of track racing. Well worth following on social media, Instagram and Twitter, Julia Elliott. Seek her out. She's got lots of interesting things to say. Hoping to get her on the podcast at some point.
Yeah, we should do. She's very cool.
Yeah.
Very cool.
She is. We're going to get her on the podcast for the winter.
She'll
at some
up our
point.
Cool factor.
Or will she make us look
considerably
worse? More lame?
Yeah,
in comparison.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, that juxtaposition.
I don't think that's in any
so doubt. She's been uninvited now. Sorry, Julia.
Sorry, Julia. That's just been rescinded in the course of about 10 seconds. Gone from an
can
invite.
Can I point out that was Rose who just invited her?
Yeah.
I like being around cool people.
Funny, if
I
we
think
get her on the
off.
Podcast Femina one day, maybe we'll all turn up, you know, having upped our game a bit.
Oh, my God. I'm just going to base it on you and what you think would be cool.
Like a baseball
cap. Have you ever had a leather jacket?
Leather jacket, if I was thinking.
I could see him in like a middle-aged Jeremy Clarkson leather jacket.
Like a member, you know, take that revival
type. Oh my god.
And you know
god.
One of those thick silver keychain belts that you have hanging from your
and
trousers?
And a nose ring.
A clip-in nose ring.
So yeah, Julia is back
please
on.
Please come, please come.
It's back on.
Oh god. Nothing.
I've never seen you try to rock cool. Just the thought of it amuses me.
Hang on, Ola.
Can
me.
I point out to our listeners what Richard is wearing? A very, very faded, much loved, much worn, no Giro t-shirt. And as I even referred to it, you tried to flex your
inspired.
Pecs there, didn't you?
I didn't.
You did. You flexed my pecs.
I just tried to suck
the girls
in my
are
stomach.
Looking.
there's a slight difference. Can we move on? Please, this is enough.
Find a new favourite topic.
Mason mentioned that the slogan on this t-shirt was inspired by you, Orla.
Yeah, I know. That was that I came up with it,
probably
didn't
your
I?
Coolest moment.
Oh, I've got lots of cool moments. Yeah.
Doesn't
I'm
need
cool
it put on a t-shirt.
To be cool. That's a different
oh my goodness, we've got that on.
I'm not cool is what I mean, and I don't care.
All right.
And I never have done.
Okay.
But there's a coolness to that. She yeah. says definitely.
Leatherette hot pants.
Yeah, I've rocked leatherette hot pants and any kind of hot pants.
If that's not trying to look
pants.
Cool, then I don't know what is.
No, that's not trying to look cool. That's comfortable. White clean. when you've got a daughter.
Okay, well,
this
anyway.
Is all,
next subject.
This is all just poured forth from this suggestion that Julia Elliott join us on the
I'll
podcast.
Dig out the
and
leatherette
all,
hot
and we're
pants.
Already desperately trying to impress her. And she's not even here yet. Oh, God, this is awful.
It's embarrassing.
Terribly embarrassing. Oh, we've all got very
let's
rare
go back
here.
To what let's we know best, on. Women's cycling.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Let's do that.
Well, let's go back to Innsbruck, sort of, because on the eve of the women's road race, I went to see Audrey Cordon-Rigaud, the French rider, to talk about, well, lots of things, and we'll hear more from her in a future episode. She's a Wiggle High Five rider. That team is disbanding. She's joining Trek Segafredo, as I believe they will now be called, because Segafredo have signed up to back the women's team as well as the men's team. She's a really interesting woman, Audrey, and she's got lots to say about lots of things. But I wanted to ask you about the team time trial, because if we can cast our minds back that far, the team time trial was on the first Sunday of the World Championships. And Kanya Schramm won the race, obviously. But Wiggle High Five raced through the first time check way ahead. And they started really fast. But they lost two riders and eventually finished fourth. So a huge disappointment for them. Here's what Audrey said a few days later.
You were on an absolute flyer as a team. Finished in the worst place imaginable, fourth. Describe that for you, because it looked like there was a lot went on there.
Basically, yeah, it's a disappointment because we've been giving our all, like everything we could. It's been really hard to be at the start because of some decisions in the team that was made a bit late, and in the end we didn't know if we were doing it. Yeah, the girls, we really pushed. We really felt like we could do something good, we had the power to do something good. Being fourth is a disappointment, but at the same time, when you see all the other teams who've been working so hard from several years, doing it for several years, it was only my second one. So it's just, I think, normal that we were fourth. Even if it's the worst place ever, it was pretty normal, and I think it could have been worst. So.
And you were down to four for quite a long time. What was that like when there were just four of you and the pressure's really on because you can't afford to lose anybody else?
Yeah, during the trainings, everything went really well, and we knew maybe Nettie would have suffered a bit more because she's coming from a big concussion. So, yeah, we decided to, as a plan, to spare her in the difficult part and to keep her with the team to be sixth as long as possible. And in the end, she was the fourth one, and Emilia and Katie have been dropped before her. That was a surprise. And it's a mistake from the team, from the whole team, from the coach, deciding to not wait for them, that we should have done, I think. So we've been talking about that after the race. And yeah, this is technically not the best choice we did, to not wait. And yeah, in the end, Nettie was also suffering a lot, so we had to wait for her. I mean, we couldn't drop her, so she was not turning anymore to stay with us. So we were only with three, pushing really hard. And yeah, I think we did a pretty good race, because with three and a half, I should say, we're still fourth, when some of the team behind us were with five or six. So I think we were really on fire. I had the legs of my season, I think, on the TTT, and I gave it all. I can tell you that the day after, I couldn't work anymore. The federation could tell you I was broken, really broken. I had the feeling that I did a marathon the day before when it was only like a TTT, but you should not have those type of feeling, you know. And I never been like this. I think I've been going through the most hard pain I never been before on this TTT, and that's why also we were super proud of us.
It shows. I mean, Canyon SRAM obviously put a lot of focus and attention on it, and I know they had a training camp here and finished with all six riders, obviously, and it looked a really well organized team performance, which is what you need, isn't it, in the team time trial. I was going to ask you what you think about the innovation for next year, the mixed team time trial.
It's difficult to give an answer as long as we never did it. I could talk about that a bit more next year, I think. But knowing what will happen, I think it's nice. I think it's really nice to come in a sport where the mixity of gender is growing. And I think it's also showing a good picture of cycling in general. Now I'm just a bit worried about how it will be organized and stuff like this, but I'm sure we will have more information before. The only point which is a bit hard for me is how should we train for it? Because, you know, everyone has a big calendar on the men and the women, and in the end, how we can train for that, that's the good question. But yeah, let's see what happened the first year, let's see how it is. I think it was a bit the same when the TTT arrived the first year. We didn't know what to expect. Yeah, let's see, but it's pretty exciting, actually.
So that was Audrey Cordon-Ragot, who, as I said, we'll hear more from in a future episode. But yeah, worst position possible for Wiggle High Five in their final, well, in everybody's final team time trial. And she is one of the riders who's looking ahead to the mixed team time trial next year, which, yeah, watch this space. I think we don't know what to expect there, but we'll
probably
know
not the Love Island TTT that we were hoping for.
No.
Yeah, disappointing that.
Yeah, they're just sticking to standard
convention.
Yeah.
Three women, three men teams. Another rider who we spoke to in Innsbruck was Pfeiffer Georgie, the young British rider who was fourth in the junior time trial. Mm-hmm. Where did she finish in the road race again? Remind me.
Yeah, Pfeiffer finished 11th in the junior road race, just outside the top 10. She has had a brilliant season. She finished first in the junior Alfredo Binda, first as well in the junior Healthy Aging Tour, second in the EPZ Omloop van Borsele, and first in the Watersley Ladies Challenge. So on the podium in every junior race that she's ridden this year.
You knew, you knew that just off the top of your head, Orla?
Very good. I had a long flight delay from Amsterdam, a lot of time to do my research. But we maybe expected a little bit more from her, didn't we?
I think she expected more from herself. Yeah. And she's obviously a great talent, joining Sunweb next year.
And quite an unusual arrangement with joining Sunweb and carrying on at school, as we'll hear now.
How has this experience been, though? I mean, what have you gained, do you think, from this week?
Yeah, it's been an amazing experience. Just even things like we got to use the Skybus, which is pretty cool. Just the race, just learning about what the level is, like, can't win everything. Trying to deal with disappointment, I think I've learned this week, because I've had a pretty good year and this maybe didn't go as well as I hoped, but there's always another race.
Tell me about next year, because you're obviously moving up into the big time next year, aren't you, with Sunweb, one of the best teams. How did that move come about?
So I've been talking to them for about the past year. I've been on a couple camps with them. Yeah, I've just really liked the team, and they offered me a contract a few weeks ago, and yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. I think I can learn a lot from them, because they're really like focused on developing young riders, which I think is pretty cool in a World Tour team. So I'm still at school next year, so I've just got to balance that, but they're really supportive of that, and yeah, hopefully I'll get to do a few World Tour races.
So another year at school first. Is that A-levels next year?
Yeah, until June I'm still at school.
Wow. That's quite unusual, signing a pro contract with a team like that and balancing it with schoolwork.
Yeah, it's really exciting, I think. It's going to be hard work, but like it's an opportunity that doesn't come around very often, so I didn't think I could turn it down because I just wanted to get my education, but I couldn't turn down this offer because I think I really benefit from it.
How was contact first made with the team? Did they get in touch with you, or did it come through British Cycling? Or
yeah, they got in touch with me, I think, after getting Wevelgem last year. I think they might notice me, and yeah, I've started talking then, and I've just...
Well, you won it, so they would have noticed you.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
No, and so they reached out to you, and contact was made, and it really developed from there.
Yeah, just a few messages, and then like went to meet them and just learn more about the team, and it just developed from there.
Have you spoken to them yet about what races you might do with them next year?
No, I haven't got that far yet. Hopefully some of the British ones, because with my exams, I can't miss too much, and yeah.
As a female rider, you know, you move from junior straight into seniors, no under 23 world championships for the women. Is that something that's disappointing for you?
Yeah, definitely. I think that, well, the men have an under 23 world champs. So yeah, I definitely think that we should have under 23 world champs. I think the racing would be amazing. There's enough women that age that will put on a good show. I'm not really sure why there isn't, to be honest.
Because it's a big step, isn't it, from going from junior. You've raced against senior women already. You know that it's, you know, you need patience, don't you, to reach that level, having been one of the top juniors in the world.
Yeah, definitely. It's a massive step. And I think that also it kind of puts some juniors moving up to the elites off if they know that their only races are with the elites, and they might get absolutely smashed by them. And so it can put people off competing anymore, which I think is a real shame. So yeah, I think under 23 worlds would be a good stepping stone.
The cycling podcast Femina is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for their continued support of the cycling podcast Femina, and you can get 25% off with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. So we heard from Pfeiffer Georgie before the break there, and unusual to carry on at school while also riding for a professional team. But Sunweb are a team that, with both their men's and women's teams, have a great reputation for developing young talent, don't they? And there are a few riders who've come through their program on the male and the female side, and they do tend to give riders a long-term plan to work towards.
I think they're also one of the teams that kind of pioneered being a bit more, on the women's side, being a bit more technical about giving people roles and having team tactics and having a plan. And I think just a couple of years ago, it was the women's team set out with the plan of, I remember, I think it was Wiggle High Five at the Tour of Flanders. We were following them in the team car. We said, oh, you know, tell us more about what the plan is going to be. They said, oh, you know, all the riders just go as far and as long as they can, then we'll see who's still in contention towards the end. I think that's the plan. But Sunweb, one of those teams that kind of pioneered, you're a domestique and this is your role. And if you just, doesn't matter if you don't finish the race, if you do that role right, then that's what we want you to do.
We saw at the women's tour, didn't we, how well they controlled the race once Corn Rivera was in the jersey. And it's just on a side note to that, I was, I don't know why, but I was listening back to our first episode from the women's tour.
One of those intense days
this,
back in those
this year, and we had
the intense.
Remember the little vox
pops?
Remember the little vox pops we had at the start of episode one, where we spoke to a selection of writers about what they were expecting. Mm. Corn Rivera called it. She said that the stage two was going to be the crucial stage, and of course she won that stage. Mm. And that was the...
We didn't notice that at the time.
We didn't notice that at the time. Well, it moves so quickly, doesn't it? By day two, we can remember anything on day one.
6 months later.
Yeah, so they are.
Gives everyone a good reason to go back and
revisit.
Yeah, I mean, quite interesting, I thought, just listening to that. That they obviously identified that as a stage that nobody else had really was talking about. It was a... I don't know why we're talking about this now, but... It was a mildly challenging finish into Daventry. There was a climb on the circuit, but yeah, that was where she laid the foundation for her overall win. But the way that the team controlled the race was very impressive, and we haven't seen that a lot of times with women's teams really riding in a block like that in front and controlling things, bringing breakaways back, including one with Audrey Cordon-Rigaud and Silla Utrecht Ludwig. Anyway, that was very threatening, that one. I've forgotten how to say it. Cecily Utrecht Ludwig.
Just say Cecily. Think of say.
More excitingly, UCI reforms. You know, the UCI do have a lot of meetings in the week of the World Championships, come up with lots of headlines, and the headline from the meeting about the reform of women's racing was minimum wage. But the devil is in the detail, isn't it? And there have been a few kind of incorrect or ambiguous reports about what that actually means. And we heard from a source close to the meeting that it might be a sliding scale of minimum wage, which doesn't sound to me like
doesn't
a minimum
make sense.
Wage
yeah,
at all.
Make sense.
With some riders on less than 10,000 euros or pounds. But then the headline was that initially it was going to be world tour level, 38,000 a year. That was corrected by Le Partillon, who said no, pro Conti level, which is 30,000 a year, more or less. But I heard him on the world feed, Le Partillon, the UCI president, talking to Anthony McCrossan, who was commentating for the world feed. And he talked quite ambiguously again about what minimum salary meant, and that it was going to be a process of aiming towards a particular figure that he didn't mention, rather than just introducing a minimum salary from 2020. The World Tour reforms that they're proposing are, in 2020, there'll be 5 World Tour teams recognised by the UCI. In 2021, there'll be 10 World Tour teams. And in 2015, in 2022, there'll be 15 World Tour teams. The problem with it is, and Ashley Moulman-Passio has pointed this out, these are all worthy ambitions and aims. You know, at the end of it, you've got a sport with 15 World Tour teams paying minimum salaries. But that's a worthy, noble ambition. But there's no detail about how to get there. There's no strategy, it seems to me, about how that's actually achieved. And you know, there are not 15 teams at the moment. There may be 5, I doubt there are 10, who would be able to pay those kinds of salaries and have that kind of infrastructure you need for a World Tour team.
I don't even know if there would be 5 teams who could pay 30,000 a year.
No.
To every single rider.
Yeah, unless you're talking about the women's branch of a men's team and they're going to take money from the men's team to be able to pay it, which would be very unfortunate, because that would mean that those kinds of teams would take precedence when it comes to getting a World Tour license, because it's not going to be decided on UCI points. They have to apply to the UCI to get these licenses, and that decision then will be based on a number of things, one of which will be whether or not they can pay a minimum wage. I mean, this has been my whole problem with the minimum wage debate right from the very beginning, because obviously it is impossible to argue against the theory of a minimum wage in any walk of life, but to say we're going to impose it from a certain date is to presuppose that teams have been holding back on this money that somehow they're sitting on, and they've got coffers of money somewhere. There has to be a strategy in place to help the teams to become more professional. And as you say, Richard, the devil is in the detail. And I do hope to give the UCI the benefit of the doubt, because I haven't really done that too much so far. I do hope they'll work closely with each of the teams, and not just the teams with the biggest sponsors, But look at the teams who do have the most UCI points, because they're doing well at races for a reason. Look at them and see how they can be professionalised, what the incentives are for them as well, other than simply becoming a World Tour team, because becoming a World Tour team also brings obligations to ride a certain number of races. There has to be a carrot approach to it as well. And I'm going to beat the same drum because it needs to be beaten, basically. Something needs to be beaten.
Because it's your drum.
But it's my bloody drum and I'll beat it if I like. It goes back to you, and Ashley Milman-Passio has been vocal about this as well, so I'm not alone. Their races, World Tour races, need to fulfil an obligation, in my mind, with regards coverage, exposure, marketing, etc., to qualify as a World Tour race. Because until we get sustained and increased eyeballs on the sport, you cannot expect sponsors to come rolling in offering minimum salaries. It needs to be promoted better, and that has to come from the top.
Yeah, monetized in a different way. I mean, like, football teams get a cut of TV rights and cycling teams don't, and that's not the model, and all the money goes to the race organizer. So I can't see how you can bring in what seems like quite a hefty financial weight onto teams when they're not getting an extra input from anyone else. And yeah, there is definitely more exposure of women cycling than there has been, and there's definitely more awareness and interest in it. That doesn't translate to more money necessarily. Mm. And it certainly doesn't, because the teams that are setting up now that we see are all women's arms of men's teams. It's not like suddenly there's a load of new standalone women's teams that are coming to the market. I mean, we thought One Pro Cycling would have one, but they clearly didn't get the sponsors, and that is kind of indicative of the money really isn't there to give. But I mean, we have to applaud the fact that there is. It was a bit sprung on me, to be honest, like, especially as listening to your interview with David Lapartien not that long ago, and when you were saying, Richard, about what is he going to do, what steps are going to be taken. Do you remember, we all listened to him, we thought. Mm-hmm. He wasn't saying anything. And you'd think that if this was rumbling in the background back then, or seemed like a conceivable thing that was going to happen next season, then he would have been more likely to mention it back
We've
then.
We've seen
I don't
these
know.
Kinds of proposals quietly delayed, shelved, dropped in the past. Mm. He needed to say something. He needed to make a grand statement on women's cycling, I believe. And let's just see where the detail, if it comes, will lie. I mean, I have to say, if and when it becomes established, then it's wonderful. We'll have a two-tier system. There'll be a very set structure. We will have a minimum salary, and the lower level of women's teams will have something to aim towards, and it will become a more professional structure. The concern is that that is being superimposed, because it's a good idea, rather than coming from the ground up and working out how to establish that. We've gone from the end result and we're working back, rather than working forward with what we've got now.
It's also one of those cases where the UCI are saying, instead of saying, oh, we've changed this and that to make it more likely that you get a minimum wage, they're just putting the onus on the teams. Mm. We say that you have to pay a minimum wage now. We're not going to help you with how to do that, but you have to do it or get out of the sport. Mm. And so I think it's just one of those things, like the TV rights. Again, with the UCI, they just kind of put the onus on the organisers to sort it out and do the streaming and make it live without coming up with anything
I'd love
themselves.
To know how much, if any, consultation there was with the teams, with the existing teams on this, because, it's a great headline, it's a noble aspiration, but if it's not realistic, if it's going to do damage, you know, if it's going to cause teams problems, then it's going to be self-defeating.
It should be said that the Cyclists Alliance have come out in favour largely of the reform. So they're very active and very involved in all kinds of discussions with regards how to advance the women's sport. So perhaps they're in a better, they are obviously in a much better position than we are to know the ramifications of everything. They're happy that things are moving in the right direction, but the likes of Ashley Milman-Passio's caution should also be noted, because that comes from a position of extreme experience.
We've had Gracie Elvin on before from the Cyclist Alliance. Maybe time to catch up with them over the next couple of episodes. And again, there's been a spotlight on them with all the CPA stuff involving mainly men's teams, although the CPA are supposed to represent women as well. They've represented them even less effectively than they've represented the men, hence the Cyclist Alliance. So maybe catch up with them. But we should wrap things up for this month. I think we've gone on quite a long time, haven't we? There'll be lots more to talk about with these UCI reforms. Don't worry.
It's not done.
Don't worry. Don't you worry. We'll return.
I've got my
drums. Drums come back out.
Return to that. For the moment, thank you very much, Orla.
Thank you very much, Boo.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you, guys.
You are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, supported by Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.